Welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food, farm, and garden edition that comes your way live every Tuesday from 1 to 2 p.m. Sometimes we go a little later if Pat's late, but generally it's 1 to 2 p.m. So glad to be with you. Lisa Almaraz, your host and producer, just excited to be having a little bit of winter, but it's looking to be extremely cold tonight here in western North Carolina, getting down to about 10 degrees. So glad we're not in sub-zero temperatures yet like we were a few years ago, but cruising right into the heart of winter now and watching things kind of die off slowly. The ground's going to start freezing and getting really hard to do. We were at the point where we could almost be still planting and doing. Things have been growing. We've actually had spring plants blooming around here because of the extreme warmth that's been going on. But now we are looking at some real winter weather, and it is truly chilly out there. Snow showers coming in tonight, and of course, we'll talk about what we can be doing along the lines of gardening. One of the fun things, of course, though, is plying through those seed catalogs. They're so much fun. The new Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Catalog, Johnny's, of course, Southern Exposure, So True Seeds, so many wonderful seed companies, and also the Seed Savers Exchange, something you can join, be part of, and support the saving and sharing of heirloom seeds around the world. That's an exciting place to also get very rare and interesting seeds. A good thing to do when there's snow on the ground, frost on the windows, and the ground is hard as a rock. So wishing you a warm midwinter time. So hoping it's cold outside, if it's supposed to be cold where you're at, and staying warm, of course, inside. Well, it is a new year, 2016, of course, brand new, many things going on out there, and a surprising bunch of new developments on companies saying that they're going to either start labeling GMOs or stop using them. So it's kind of exciting, but I still encourage you to eat only organic food because, honestly, there are so many other non-food type chemicals and products in the processed foods that are out there that they're no business going in your mouth. They're not food. They're just food-like products in most cases, and you just want to avoid the toxic things. You also want to avoid eating out of soft plastic bottles, okay? That's also been found. All plastic containers basically are hormone disruptors because of the chemicals they have in them. Go with glass if you can. Drink things, eat things that don't have a commercial. That's always a good thing. Support those local farmers and keep it organic as you go. But when it comes to one of the old standard American brands, Campbell's Soup. Well, they've seen some sales dropping, and now, as of last week, Campbell's has decided they're going to disclose GMO ingredients. Breaking from their industry rivals, Campbell's Soup will become the first major food company to begin disclosing the presence of genetically engineered ingredients like corn, soy, and sugar beets in its products. The company, the maker of brands like Pepperidge Farm, Prego, Plum Organics, and V8, in addition to its namesake soups, is taking this unusual step. They're risking some sales, but, you know, in the long run, I think they've seen the example of, for instance, Chipotle, who says, we're not going to use GMOs, we're going to let you know if they're there. And their market share goes up, and the sales increase, and people appreciate that. That is what people want. They want to know what's in their food. And so they're taking this little risk to be ahead of the pack. But that's the only way that you're really a leader, is if you can be ahead of the pack. It's certainly been long enough of people wanting these labels, so it's not like they're truly cutting-edge trendsetters, but at least they're finally going to start letting their customers know about genetically modified ingredients. Big food corporations are facing increasing pressure to be more open about their use of such ingredients. Food companies have begun printing labels to comply with a new labeling law in Vermont. And Vermont could not be stopped. They wanted labels there, and they have fought for it, and they're coming. They are coming in July. Vermont will be requiring disclosure of genetically engineered ingredients, a measure opposed by most major food companies. They are seeking to supersede any state's legislation with the voluntary federal solution, and we are happy that did not get into the spending bill. They were going to try to make it illegal for states to label. That did not make it in there, and we're looking for some progress in this area. So pretty interesting when we're looking at Campbell's company and all of the different labels that they produce under. They're calling for mandatory GMO labeling of their products. And basically, the people there at Campbell's, such as Denise Morrison, she's the chief executive. She says they're optimistic that a federal solution can be reached in a reasonable amount of time, but if that's not the case, we're preparing to label all our products across the portfolio. That is the chief executive officer of Campbell's. And she just went ahead and admitted about 3/4 of the company's products contained ingredients derived from the corn, canola, soybeans, or sugar beets. These are the 4 largest genetically engineered crops, and about 75% of their products contain them. So when I tell you that just about everything out there, the large majority of foods that are not organic, they have GMOs, okay? It's pervasive at this point. It used to be kind of a tough thing to find. Oh, I wonder, you know, if this could possibly have genetically engineered corn or something. Oh, no, no, no. This was a long time ago. Now, it is pervasive. Between the amounts of canola being added out there, soybeans, and sweeteners from sugar beets and corn and high fructose corn syrup, you've got GMOs all over the place, including on every restaurant table in the ketchup bottle. Okay, so, you know, really eating organic is truly very important. And the gentleman who proved just how horrible GMOs can be on the studies that he did on rats in France, he won his suit of defamation. They tried to make his study look like it wasn't right. It was. It was true. He found these results, and don't fool yourself into thinking they're safe. They have not been proven safe. We've just been given a lot of fake studies that have told us that they are, and we're learning more and more about how unsound the science is out there. Large, large companies owning research firms, pumping out basically lies in the form of fake studies or botched studies or studies set up to make things look a certain way. When you really dig below, you see the truth of it. And you know, what we eat today affects us tomorrow. What time we go to bed tonight affects how awake we are in the morning or not, right? It's all connected. We have the power to make the changes. It's our own willingness to get out of bed with a great attitude, to reach for that organic food, to drink that water, to smile at those people out there that may or may not be our friends. It takes our choice, right? It's not the past that defines us. We can decide now the direction we're going, but yet our past has a profound effect on us, and especially when it comes to dietary habits, right? You know, geneticists have long told us that, oh, certain people, oh, they're prone to this disease or that disease. And in many cases, you can see genetic markers. But more often, what you find is families have traditions of eating horrible food. Hey, you know, just like grandma's heavy-duty toxic thing that she ate. Oh, yeah, we're making that this Sunday. Well, it's tradition, right? We love tradition and food. But yet, with modern ingredients that are not nearly as wholesome as grandma's, next thing you know, we end up with all these other diseases going on. All kinds of gut dysbiosis. And what does that mean? It means your gut doesn't work. It's dysfunctional. It's being sabotaged. And honestly, the pesticides and GMOs and all of that wrapped up in all of today's perfectly looking toxic food kills those good gut microbes that are the basis of our immune system and our ability to digest and absorb nutrients. So what we ate back in the 80s is linked to how we feel today, if we were alive back then. Of course, I've been alive quite a bit longer than that. And now we have a new study, actually, from Bioscience Technology. Thank you for people in applications in life science there at biosciencetechnology.com. Pesticides found in milk all the way from the 80s may be linked to signs of Parkinson's that are developing in people today. When we link up the past and what we've been eating and all of the junk we've been eating for decades and products that are out there that aren't really food, it has an effect on us today. It has an effect on whether we're sick or dying of something, and maybe we need to take that same diet back and heal. Heal with that wonderful organic food. But this new study in neurology has found that it's a total neurology study finding potential association between a pesticide found in milk more than 2 decades ago and signs of Parkinson's disease in the brain. Now, we also have a ton of compelling, very revolutionary new information about just how directly our brain health is affected by our gut health. So our gut health is critical to how our brain functions. And that's why it's even more important not to be causing gut dysbiosis with a bunch of pesticides killing our little microbial community in our gut, because that's going to be destroying our brain's ability to really function well for us. And what does that make us if we don't have our brain functioning well? Pretty zombied out, right? Could be pretty easy to herd around in any direction. We've got to be able to have our wits about us. We've got to have our sharp mental capacities going on. We've got to be awake, aware, alive, and compassionate toward each other and the world around us. We need our brains to work well. That's why we've got to protect our gut and foster those relationships in the gut that allow a dynamic and synergistic vitality between our gut and our health to exist, our gut and our brain health to exist. What we're seeing, and this is according to the lead author of the study, R.D. Abbott, Ph.D. with the Shiga University of Medical Science in Otsu, Japan. He told Bioscience Technology, we are beginning to learn that diet may have a distinct role in Parkinson's disease. In particular, their data suggests it can be related to an early loss in neurons prior to the onset of Parkinson's disease. So it sets the stage. Neuron loss in a critical region of the brain that is associated with Parkinson's disease needs to reach critical levels before the classic symptoms of Parkinson's disease can appear. They have found that high intake of milk affects this pre-critical phase. So the study focused on 449 Japanese-American men who participated in the Honolulu Asia Aging Study with an average age of 54. The men were followed for more than 30 years and autopsies were performed after death. Abbott said all 449 men participating were examined for loss of brain cells in the substantia nigra area, which is important for the study of Parkinson's and the critical region of the brain that we mentioned here. The amount of residue from a pesticide called heptachlor epoxide was measured in 116 of these 449 men's brains. Heptachlor epoxide. Yes, this pesticide was used in the pineapple industry in Hawaii and was found at very high levels in the milk supply there in the early 1980s, according to the press release. It was used to kill insects and no longer used in the U.S. beginning around that time. These men were non-smokers, relatively healthy, but of the folks whose brains were examined for residues of heptachlor epoxide, residues were found in 63% of those who didn't even drink any milk, compared to 90% of the people who drank the most milk. It's unknown if the milk participants drank the pesticides directly. Of course, they probably didn't. But, you know, these generalizable findings look at just how much these residues build up, how they affect our organs and our ongoing health. So the next time you're deciding whether to eat healthy or just splurge and have that junky meal, think again and choose organic, choose healthier. You'll feel better, get grounded, reduce inflammation, protect your gut. And let's quit eating pesticides. It's great to see. You can do it. It's just every day making the choices that count. Make them count for the most. Eating is your biggest thing you do every day that affects the world in general. Because of all of the things that are landed on that plate, where did they come from? Where did they get shipped in from? What farmer produced them? How many toxins are in them? What conditions were they grown under? You know, it's a huge decision that affects the entire world around us. And you know, when we bring in that biodiversity in our diet, and we honor the biodiversity around us, and the biodiversity in our gut, and the biodiversity of insects out there, and plants and everything, we are uplifted. We are stronger. Nature can maintain more balance and restore balance to a greater extent with more biodiversity, because all those little creatures out there out in nature, in the earth that we share this beautiful planet with, they have purposes and possibilities on what they do in their environment that we're barely scratching the surface of understanding. I've loved roly-poly since I was a little bitty girl. That's the first little insect I really kind of connected with. And it's not even an insect. I found out the other day, all this time I thought it was a bug. No, roly-polies are actually cetaceans. They have 7 pairs of legs, 14 legs, little cetaceans that roll up in a ball when they get shy or when you're bothering them. They're found down in the crack of the sidewalk where the grass is growing in the middle of the, on the edge of the sidewalk there. Roly-polies have the ability to basically crystallize heavy metal ions in the soil and turn them into a little pellet that is inane. It doesn't even hurt us. They are transformers of the toxins around us. They are great for bioremediation. They have a marsupium. They have a little pouch for their little eggs that they walk around with. We learn more every day about things that we've overlooked all of our life. And that's just the beginning. That's just the tip of the iceberg of all of the creatures that we barely know anything about. So that's why it's so important to honor all life and honor all of the animals and all the insects and the bats and the birds and the bees, because we don't know what purpose they serve out there. Sometimes we think we know. We see it on the what appears to be their obvious purpose, but then we don't know the bigger picture. Nature has got a living web of life that's woven so many layers deep and intricately and synergistically. We are but students here in this world. And that's why it really just breaks my heart when I hear about massive death of animals, sometimes directly by the hands of humans, sometimes indirectly, like the vast die-off of millions of creatures that has been happening in the Pacific Ocean. Hundreds and even thousands of whales, seals, dolphins found. And then we say, oh, we're going to give the Navy permits so we can go kill 10 to 15 more marine animals over the next 4 or 5 years so we can do bombs and test things in the water where they live. How irresponsible is that? And then meanwhile, last week, we have the government guidelines coming out to say, oh, eat more seafood. Why? Eat it up quick because we're about to kill it all? I mean, you know, we can't be doing these things. We can't be doing these things. And, you know, we've got Fukushima spewing over there. We've got all that radiation burning animals. We've got mass starfish die-offs all over the Pacific. Huge, huge, huge amounts of death out there with the animals. Directly because of human activity. Some pretty diabolical human activity going on. Shame on us, honestly, but I always have hope. But when you see things like blatant destruction, you know, it's really disgusting. It just disappoints me that we are that horrid. You know, we have a responsibility to be Earth stewards, and that's what we're supposed to do. And my heart goes out to Mauritius. The Mauritius bat cull has been going on. Their death toll of bats in this little island is over 20,000 now. Vikash Tataya, conservation director for the Mauritian Wildlife Foundation, has confirmed the official government-endorsed cull of the threatened, the endangered Mauritian flying fox. Beautiful flying fox. Taropus niger is officially over, finally, at least for this year. They've stopped murdering massive amounts of these endangered and beautiful, beautiful creatures that deserve life on Earth every bit as much as every human being. That's my And I am just appalled when I see things like this. And, you know, we've got to speak out. I feel like speaking out to the Mauritian government, how can they do this over and over? Why? Because humans are greedy and they want to, hoard all of whatever food they're growing or different things like that without really understanding the importance of biodiversity, of the role they play. And what do they end up with? With this mass murder, you end up with a lot of other problems that you have no idea how to deal with because the bats were filling a key role in nature and you have no concept. You know, people that do these mass murders have no concept of just how intricate that web of life is. It's really awful to find out about it. The official cull has ended. Thousands more are thought to have been illegally killed, and the illegal killing continues. While we will never know the true number of bats killed there in Mauritius, experts state there is no doubt the government's target to kill 20,000 threatened Mauritian flying foxes was exceeded. Vikash is very concerned that the bats are in dire straits as the cyclone season has begun. The government approved cull in hope that fewer bats would help reduce damages to fruits like mangoes and lychees in orchards and boost revenues for fruit farmers. Greedy fruit farmers is where this is coming from. Not exactly my kind of farmer. You know, I'm always talking and bugging you to support farmers. Well, I don't support these farmers and their horrible methods, their murderous methods there that are in complete disrespect of nature and the world around them. Prior to the call, conservation leaders in Mauritius and around the world took a stand and voiced serious concerns over the decision by the Mauritian government to conduct the call, especially as it was based on questionable science that was contradicted by new research and extensive expert opinion. This decision sets a dangerous precedent. And this is from Dr. Simon Stewart, chair of the IUCN Species Survival Commission. It sets a dangerous precedent. It could be one of the first times that culling of a globally threatened species has been authorized against all the scientific evidence and when there are more effective alternatives available. Bat Conservation International, joined with Mauritian Wildlife Foundation, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, Species Survival Commission, and many others, in asking the government to reconsider their decision. Thousands of the BCI members and other dedicated conservationists from Mauritius and around the world voiced concerns. And they still didn't end this call. And these little bats, you know, bats are endangered all over the world. And we're finding out just how negatively they can be affected by much of our technology. We need our bats. We need our little critters out there. And they're part of life. And we need to respect that. You know, I've learned a lot in the last few years working with Living Web Farms and learning about biodiversity and insects and how you don't go out there with a poison to kill one whole population of insects. You just bring in the predator, balance it out. You know, we see that in ecosystems where humans try to go in and kill all of one thing and they don't really think about how to balance it out, how to have nature be a balance of itself. That's what it's done all this time. That's how it works. That's what's going on out there in nature. Things are all working to stay in balance. And then here comes the human. Bam, crash, boom, bam, whack, whack, death, destruction, severe imbalance. And when we're not stopping, looking, learning from nature, that's what we're doing. We're causing a ton more problems, not only for ourselves, but for all the other creatures out there that we're hogging the world from, and we need to learn to share a lot better. So I really love animals. You know, I just really love animals, and I feel very protective of them because people are so destructive, and I just want to encourage us to speak out. Get in touch when it counts. If you see some kind of animal cruelty or you see some destruction going on, you know, call the right organizations. Get in touch with the right agencies. Speak out. Because it's important. These things are just sliding right by. You know, they've got those permits out there to be blowing up millions and millions of sea animals' ears and destroying their breeding grounds. And all these things are out there floating by waiting for us to jump in and care enough to actually get involved. And you know, when you really care enough to actually get involved, that's what community is. That's what we need. We need to help each other. And sometimes we have to help each other snap out of it when we're really not paying attention to what makes sense. Learning from nature instead of working against it. Speaking of nature and working against it, thanks to nature.com for this story. Yes, just there in December, the United States government has now approved transgenic chicken. You know, I saw some pretty gross pictures the other day of some chickens that were being slaughtered for Kentucky Fried Chicken. And, you know, there was feet growing off their wings. There was all kinds of mutations going on. And people are eating that stuff. Of course, by the time you process it, you don't see all the mutations. But it's still contaminated meat that's not from normal chickens. Now we have this approved transgenic chicken. We were already getting transgenic chicken from them eating tons of GMOs, right? Now we have real transgenic chicken engineered to produce pharmaceutical drugs in their eggs. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, let's just go ahead. They figure, hey, let's just go ahead and combine all the foods and the drugs, right? We're the Food and Drug Administration. Let's go ahead and just breed it right in. They have approved a chicken that has been genetically engineered to produce a drug, Kanuma. It is actually called Sebalipase Alpha. It's a recombinant human enzyme marketed by Alexion Pharmaceuticals. Replaces an enzyme in people. It says, they say, a faulty enzyme. You know, I'm not going to go and pretend that genetically engineering something is more perfect than what nature has done. So I'm going to take out the word faulty, and I'm just going to say it replaces an enzyme in people with a rare inherited condition that prevents the body from breaking down fatty molecules in cells. So it is a cebulopase alpha, and it's to help break down those fatty molecules in cells. Now, there's things out there. There's things out there that do that, and, you know, they've not been the best for us. We had hundreds and hundreds of millions of gallons of Corexit dumped into the Gulf of Mexico, contaminating it, pretty much ruining ecosystems all over the Gulf of Mexico. That had a synthetic flesh-eating bacteria in there and a oil-dissolving chemical that dissolves the fats, right? So that we didn't get to see all of that biggest oil disaster in American history washing up on the shores of the Gulf all over the place. No, we didn't see it. We just dumped a bunch of solvent in there and dissolved that oil so it could turn into billions of tiny little bubbles of oil that sunk to the bottom to kill the entire food chain in the Gulf from the bottom up. And that's what's been going on in the Gulf ever since. That corrects it. Fumes and the toxins from it started blowing ashore, washing ashore, and people's lipids started dissolving in their own body. They would suffer mass bruising and all this stuff, and a lot of people died from it. We don't hear a lot about it, but a lot of people have died along the Gulf from that. So sometimes when you're looking at things that are going to be dissolving lipids and fats are very important in our body, you may want to watch out with those, right? And who knows how, you know, things always get cross-pollinated, cross-contaminated, mixed up. How do we know that only the people with the rare disease are going to get these eggs? How do we know that? They could get mixed up with other chickens. You know, there's all kinds of ways things get contaminated. So very interesting to see. Following its approval by the FDA on December 8th, Conuma joins a small group of pharmaceuticals on the United States market. In 2009, the agency, they call them FARM, Pharmaceuticals, okay? In 2009, the agency approved genetically modified goats that produce an anticoagulant called antithrombin in their milk. And last year, the FDA authorized a drug for treating hereditary angioedema that is produced by transgenic rabbits. So interesting here, the FDA did move quite quickly to consider this new transgenic chicken, giving it a priority review, orphan drug status, and a breakthrough therapy designation. Hey, swing open all the doors to get more of these things out there, right? The disease that is designed to treat liposomal acid lipase deficiency, it is designed to treat that. Liposomal acid lipase deficiency. So people don't have the ability to dissolve those fatty compounds. And it causes fat to accumulate in the liver, spleen, and vasculature, which, of course, is not healthy for us. A form of the disease strikes sometimes can be fatal, especially for infants. A second form that affects older patients can cause liver enlargement, fibrosis, other problems, cardiovascular disease, cirrhosis, etc. But, you know, like I always say, there's got to be something that's natural out there that would do the same thing without the side effects. And that's always where I fall with these mysterious chemicals that we keep spewing out at high pace into our environment and consuming and promoting and legislating people to eat and injecting people with and all the rest, is that there's got to be something natural that's better. And that's why all these companies are out there synthesizing natural compounds from plants so that they can make the pharmaceutical. They're getting it from nature. They're not actually creating this stuff. They're synthesizing and patenting things that are already out there in nature that are far superior without the side effects and with lots of great benefits. So instead of a bunch of horrendous side effects, you actually get a huge list of wonderful synergistic benefits when you eat from nature like that. So it's really wonderful to see. And as I say, let's get more public garden plots everywhere. Let's get more food independence going on. Let's get more gardens growing, sequestering carbon, enjoying sharing in our gardens together in community. And I'm so happy to see that we are looking at more public garden plots being planned for 2016 than ever before. We've got people working out there like Incredible Edible, They have a, they're doing vegetable plots all over the place. There's townspeople coming together for projects all over the world. We've got people learning more about horticulture. People are even planting these gardens all along in their cities. We're getting more and more of the various gardens at schools. As I'm always mentioning, we need more of that. And we've got it. We've got it happening. And it's going on all over. Children will be able to eat healthier, and you know, it costs less when you're growing those wonderful foods yourself. So there is a lot happening. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to see. And even up the road here in Cherokee, we've got more community gardens. They're going to be feeding the children that live out in the reservation. And there are also other Native peoples that are doing garden projects and bringing back Native species out there. So lots of bright spots on the horizon regarding gardening and spreading that wisdom of great organic dynamics in the soil to build our soil, to create more nutrients in the food. It's very exciting. And that's why it's so monumental of a task and so tiny and unassuming to plant that seed, to plant a seed that you're going to eat from, to plant the seed of gardening in your own heart and in the heart of others. It's such a great, monumental, yet small, seemingly incidental task to plant a seed of gardening in a child, in an elder, in anyone. And so share information like livingwebfarms.org and check out all those workshop videos and tell other people about them and give someone a few extra seeds or maybe a few extra plants to get them started on their garden this year, because it will change their life and it will reestablish and fortify their relationship to the earth. And that creates more personal balance, happiness, actually. The microbes in the soil actually are an antidepressant. They're effective in creating happier moods in people. You know, that wonderful smell of the earth when you're out there. Now, granted, it's frozen right now out there, but, you know, getting someone in touch with growing food and gardening and planting that seed of pure organic food in their heart that they want to do that, they want to participate in growing their food, that can change a person's life for the better in every single way, really, because they end up eating better food, they get healthier, they function better, they feel better, they look better. You know, it just goes all the way around. And so these things we do, the things that we do, small things day by day, they really do add up, especially when we share them with each other. And, you know, over time, we can encourage more young people to be involved in horticulture. We've got sales increasing in horticulture around the country. This just out from Washington, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service released the 2014 Census of Horticultural Specialties report that was out just from last year, shows that horticulture operations sold a total of $13.8 billion in floriculture. Nursery and specialty crops went up 18% since 2009. The number of horticulture operations in the United States increased 8% during this time to 23,221. This report contains the results of the 10th Census of Horticultural Specialties. I didn't even know there was such a thing. A Census of Horticultural Specialties. Very interesting. And this is from the chairman of the Agricultural Statistics Board, Mike Harris. First conducted in 1889, the Horticulture Census provides data on industries for which there are no other comprehensive data sources. It's a valuable tool to highlight the contribution horticulture growers bring to state-level economies, whether in sales earned or expenses paid for hired labor. Horticulture production was concentrated in 10 states, which accounted for 65% of all U.S. horticulture sales in 2014. California led the way with $2.88 billion in sales, Florida next, $1.8 billion, and Oregon just behind them at $932 million. Those are the top three leading the nation in sales. Other key findings there from the 2014 Census of Horticultural Specialties include family or individually owned operations made up the largest number
of operations, accounting for 53%. But corporately owned operations accounted for 76% of sales. So even though we have more than half of the operations being small family and smaller type companies, three-quarters of the share of sales, the lion's share, is from the corporate-owned operations. Total industry expenses were up 16% since 2009, with labor being the largest in the total industry expenses going up, accounting for 37% of total expenses in 2014. Food crops grown undercover gained in prominence as the number of operations engaged in this practice increased 71%. 71% growing of covering things in greenhouse production. The top commodities in U.S. horticulture sales reflect this very diversity. Sold in 2014 compared to 2009, things have changed a little bit. Nursery stock has gone up 11% to $4.2 billion. We've got $2.57 billion in annual bedding and garden plants. That's up 11%. And that's why it is so important that we get Home Depot and Lowe's and Walmart and all those big box stores to hurry up and get those neonicotinoid-laden plants out of their stores. We're killing the bees, people. It's so important. Home Depot, I'm kind of proud of you. They said, hey, we're going to get rid of about 80% of all of our plants that have neonicotinoids. And then they said by, you know, several years from now, by 2018 or something. No, that is not fast enough. It can be done now. It doesn't matter if you have contracts for this stuff. They need to be renegotiated because we cannot risk losing our bees. We need to renegotiate that. We need to get those things out of the stores. That 11% increase, around $3 billion worth of annual bedding and garden plants, and over half of them have neonicotinoids. That is not a risk we can be taking. So we've got to be shifting that neonicotinoid pesticide out of there much sooner. But then we look at more horticultural sales increase, up 30% sod, sprigs, and plugs. 30% increase up to $1.14 billion. Potted flowering plants up 24%. $1 billion just in potted flowering plants. We've got potted herbaceous perennials selling $945 million worth. That's up 12%. We've got food crops under protection in greenhouses up 44%, $797 million in sales. This is exciting to me because it really shows what's going on in horticultural sales in a big way. Things are really increasing. The sales are really increasing. And so, best of luck to all of those family and smaller operations out there that are growing things organically, that are committed to protecting our bees and pollinators and our bats and our birds by selling non-poison plants. Just because things are beautiful and look perfect, if they're covered in poisons, well, we can't have them. And we need to shift over to that. So, you know, hoping for the best for all of those smaller operations that do things in a clean way, because that's what we need. We need clean plants that are not going to kill our pesticide, our little pollinators. It's critical. It's absolutely critical. But great to see that we have massive increase in horticultural sales. Massive. Massive increase. Lisa Almaraz here with you, Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition, where we make all those connections apparent. We explore the ideas from several different angles. And yes, tons of opinion from me, lots of opinionated perspective here for sustainability, for what works, for protecting nature, and for living organically and sustainably. That's definitely the bias here that you will find on every show. So, no straight-up journalism on Earth Heart Network Radio. No, sir. We've got tons of opinion. This is an ongoing editorial, and that's why I do it, because I really think it's important to give the emotional side and the common sense side and not just be a spewer of the basic facts, but to really put them in perspective. And so it's great. It's great that we put things in perspective when we realize we move markets. Our choices for food, our choices for how we obtain our food, our choices for how we live totally move markets. Every dollar we spend has an effect on the company we're spending it on and on the company that we're not spending it on. And we've got to take that power into our hands. We've got to really realize just how much impact we can have. And now for a nice update on Kellogg's company. Yes, speaking of unchoosing certain things, Kellogg's sales have fallen again there in the last quarter of 2015 as U.S. consumers shun the cereals and snacks. Their net sales fell for the eighth quarter out of nine. That's the eighth quarter of a year. Sales dropped again at Kellogg's. U.S. snacks and cereals, people are choosing away from that stuff. They know there's GMOs. They know it's toxic. People are making better choices. I encourage you to really fortify your choices as you're making them. Shares in Kellogg's went down by about 5% here at the end of the year. The CEO thinks they're making some improvements, but people are starting to really choose differently. And some of these companies who are not innovating and who are staying stuck in the mud and the old ways and won't label and this and that, they're going to lose out. And that's why Campbell's is jumping ahead and starting some labeling, because they want to be moving forward with saying, hey, at least we're doing something. And they've got to comply with those Vermont laws as well. And so that's quite important to be able to comply with that. But, you know, we can plant seeds. We can even make seed balls and throw those out there in random places, share them with friends. We can plant seeds of activism, of stewardship all along the way. And with children, it's especially important. And, you know, we've been given so much information these days that we have to sift through. Sifting and sorting through the baloney out there is a pretty big job when it comes to being careful about what you're inputting, unless you're just going to be brain polluted by all of the baloney. You've got to be aware. You've got to be aware of exactly what's going on and not just what you're being shown. And, you know, Americans are pretty lazy sometimes. You know, we work all day, we come home, we want to just kick back and zombie out in front of the TV or something. Well, I quit doing that a very, very long time ago. I couldn't stand it anymore, you know, to have that as my life, so I changed it. It was so much obvious drivel on the television, I just couldn't sit there and do that to myself anymore. But when we come to scientific information, we've also got a lot of falsehoods going on. As I mentioned earlier, you know, there, and it's funny because we've got a study to find out about studies, right? This is what we end up doing. We have to make a study about studies. And that's what they've done over at True Activist. The study last year found that nearly all scientific papers, nearly all, there's a huge amount of them out there, are controlled by just six corporations. And it's a study conducted by Professor Vincent Larivière from the University of Montreal's School of Library and Information Science. And a number of other researchers there as well found that nearly all major scientific papers are controlled by the same six corporations. The researchers sifted through tons of studies that were published between the years of 1973 and 2013. They found that the studies were overwhelmingly published by the same six publishers. The publishers named in the study are ACS, Reed Elsevier, Sage, Taylor & Francis, Springer, and Wiley-Blackwell. Now, none of those names really sound very familiar, do they? Until you dig below the surface, and that's what they did. Larivière found that this creates problems, saying as long as publishing in high-impact factor journals is a requirement for researchers to obtain positions, research funding, and recognition from peers, the major commercial publishers will maintain their hold on the academic publishing system. It's like your ticket, right? You publish something, you get accepted or not, and therefore you get into the inner circle of rising in the ranks if you write things the way that the publishers want them to be written. And scientists know this. I've known scientists personally who, oh, I have to write it a certain way or it won't get published. And, you know, your big mark, your big badge of honor when you're a scientist is how many published papers you have. If you don't have a lot of published papers, you don't get very far. So very interesting how we've got this stranglehold on truthful research by academic seniority based on the gatekeepers of publishers allowing the papers to get out or not by these very scientists who are seeking to get ahead. pretty amazing, you know, how we've got that going on. Six corporations controlling just about all major scientific papers that are out there. This is a free and open source article. You can check it out. You can even republish it under trueactivist.com. It's a Creative Commons license. And you can share that information. Yep. And the people that are scientists that worked all their years just to be able to fit into that system, feels a little futile, doesn't it? Not really making a big, huge difference. And then you get stuck. You get stuck in the system. So we've got to realize that there's a lot more surface than just what meets the eye to dig into and to look deeper. And sometimes we can look literally deeper and realize how we're affecting things. Yes, I'm talking about sea turtles underneath the surface down there in Florida. Yes, sea turtles are suffering from plastic bags that are out there. They get hooked up in stuff, all the junk we put out there. Of course, styrofoam that breaks apart. They think it's food. They eat that, get poisoned from that. But sea turtles in our oceans are basically mistaking plastic bags as jellyfish. They think they're jellyfish, and that's their main source of food. According to the World Wildlife Foundation and the Loggerhead Marine Life Center, all sea turtles are endangered. Their team of 9 to 12-year-olds, the Hobie Sound Boys and Girls Club, first Lego League robot rulers, are very concerned about the problem. Yes, there's some kids down there. There's some kids down in Florida that are speaking out for the little sea turtles. Florida has over 1,350 miles of coastline. And those kids love the sea turtles on the beaches, and they want to stop the pollution. And so they're asking you to sign a petition on change.org for Florida Governor Joe Negron to save the sea turtles and ban plastic bags from the large retailers. They've done it out in California. Through the research, they discovered California and Hawaii have banned plastic bags from large retail stores to help stop ocean pollution. They want to see the same thing happen in Florida to keep their sea turtle population alive. They're creating this petition to ban plastic bags in Florida, and they're contacting the governor and local senator for help. So I encourage you to go to change.org. Florida Governor Joe Negron, save the sea turtles. Look for that petition there. I am clicking sign right now. Boom. There we go. Okay. Let's be the voice for the sea turtles. They need us. They are part of our biodiversity, right? They are part of a healthy ocean. They find out, you know, when you look at, you put clams in a tank and you look at the clarity of the water, and the clams basically filter the water and they really keep it clean and in balance. And then you take the clams out of the little ecosystem and you get this cloudy, diseased, dirty water that does not resemble a clean ocean. And so all of the critters, every single creature out there, has a role to play in nature to keep things in balance. And sometimes we have no idea what that is. We just need to respect them and let them do what they're here to do. And let people do what they're here to do. People want to live a healthy, happy life. But when you live next door to, say, for instance, genetically modified corn testing grounds, well, you might have a lot of problems. Hawaii is finding this out. Hawaii has seen a tenfold increase in birth defects after becoming genetically modified corn testing grounds. Yes, thank you to naturalmedication.org. Doctors are sounding the alarm after noticing a disturbing trend happening in Waimea on the island of Kauai, Hawaii. Because of genetically modified foods over the past 5 years, the number of severe heart malformations has risen to more than 10 times the national rate, according to an analysis by local physicians. Pediatrician Carla Nelson, after seeing four of these defects in 3 years, is extremely concerned with the severe health anomalies manifesting in the local population. Nelson, as well as a number of other local doctors, find themselves at the center of a growing controversy about whether the substantial increase in severe illness and birth defects in Waimea are stemming from the main cash crop on four of the six islands' genetically modified corn. It has been altered to resist pesticides, which means they put on a lot more pesticides to kill everything else. Hawaii has historically been used as a testing ground for almost all GMO corn grown in the United States. And that's such a pristine environment. So we're basically contaminating one of the most beautiful paradise places on Earth. Over 90% of genetically modified foods like corn grown in the mainland U.S. was first developed in Hawaii, with the island of Kauai having the largest area used. According to a report in The Guardian, in Kauai, chemical companies Dow, BASF, Syngenta, and DuPont spray 17 times more pesticide per acre, mostly herbicides, along with insecticides and fungicides. They spray 17 times. That's 1,700 times more than an ordinary cornfield in the United States mainland. So that means they're poisoning 17 times more, poisoning the air, the soil, the water, the people, the animals. Okay, this is according to the most detailed study of the sector by the Center for Food Safety. That's because they are precisely testing the strain's resistance to herbicides that kill other plants. So they want to say, okay, how much more can we put on and see how far we can push this? Meanwhile, the people are suffering. Babies are being born with deformed hearts. All of these things, 10 times more than anywhere else around there. About a fourth of the total are called restricted use pesticides because of their harmfulness. Just in Kauai, 18 tons, mostly atrazine, paraquat, both banned in Europe, and chlorpyrifos were applied in 2012. The World Health Organization this year announced that glyphosate, sold as Roundup, the most common of the non-restricted herbicides, is probably carcinogenic to humans. So here you have in Waimea, a small town that lies downhill from the 12,000 acres of GMO testing fields, leased mainly from the state. Spraying takes place 17 times more than on mainland crops, often, sometimes every couple of days. Residents have complained that when the wind blows downhill from the fields, the chemicals cause headaches, vomiting, stinging eyes. Your eyes and lungs hurt. You feel nauseous. The school children are getting sick, and 10 times more birth defects. To add insult to injury, Dow AgriSciences' main lobbyist in Honolulu, until recently, actually ran the main hospital. So we weren't getting all the information. Well, we've got more information now, and it's just one more example of why we need to support organic growing everywhere and to keep eating it every time we have a chance. Like Patrick Battle, who does it and grows it and shares it for many years now. He joins us for This Week in the Garden. Pat, how are you doing today?
Hey, Lisa, I'm staying warm. How about you?
Oh, I'm staying warm and the wind is blowing. The chimes are dinging out there. I think we're supposed to have some snow showers tonight, right? And then down to around 10 degrees. So
yep.
I'm hoping we're not going to have ice on the roads in the morning, because I've been having these very early morning forays on a very windy road. So I'm just hoping that won't be.
Well, the good news is around here, Lisa, if there's ice, they'll cancel school in a flash.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so anyway, it's not much of a day for people to be working outside. Though if you haven't protected your remaining outdoor crops, let's say, like we actually let our kale and our collards kind of coast, didn't cover them at all, and they took very little damage because they got to cool down slowly until yesterday, and then we pulled the covers over them. And that should do it. They shouldn't take too much damage, even though it's going to get deeply cold. And it's not too late to do that. If you have stuff that's still looking pretty good, chances are it won't look as good after tonight. Likewise, we have rutabagas in the ground. We just pulled all of our turnips. You saw them, Lisa. They were out in the four-acre field. We don't get out there much. They got to the size of small pumpkins, and they still have plenty of good quality, but it was definitely way past time to pull them. So we pulled all of our turnips, and they're all going to the food banks. But we're leaving in our rutabagas because they can still continue to put lots of size on, and they just get better and better quality as they sit out there and survive the cold. If they don't take damage, they'd get a deeper and deeper orange color. That's probably carotene, I'm guessing, but it makes them incredibly richly flavored. And the more cold, the better, as long as they have protection. And we've tried two forms of protection. Row cover, I think, will probably be enough. They're pretty darn hardy, but they can definitely take a hit on nights like tonight when it's going to get down in the, if they're predicting 10, there's a good chance there'll be microclimates that go into the high single digits, you know. And that's a hard hit for any winter vegetable. Mosh is one of the few that would show no real damage at all. Most vegetables will show some damage by the time you get down to that temperature. But that row cover will hopefully slow down the speed at which they get cold enough that they won't take any serious damage. The other thing you can do is, at this point, the tops, they can always grow back. They've got that whole root, and they'll grow back if they get damaged much. And so you might want to not try to struggle with row cover. This will be the I Love Lucy show today. If you're putting row cover out today, the wind is blowing quite a bit, and you will want some help. Remember always to anchor it from the windward side first. That'll make it easier, but it's going to be a challenge. You might decide, I don't want to mess with the row cover. If you have some leaves that are not all fluffy, because they'll just blow away right away, but have been either picked up by a mulching mower or one of those other systems that kind of chops them, or have sat in a pile long enough that they've gotten kind of wet now and they've had some fungi growing on them so that they're never going to really dry out. They're always going to be kind of heavier. Those kind of leaves or straw can just be piled around the roots of the rutabaga. You know, rutabagas are considered a root, but very little of them are in the ground. Most of that root grows up above the ground, and that's the part that's going to take damage. So if you can just loosely cover them, they shouldn't freeze too hard. They should be fine. Another thing you could try, which I have not tried, I can't guarantee it works, but it might be easier to do, would be to use branches of conifers. So if you have some conifer, maybe they haven't, you haven't mulched your Christmas tree yet. If you cut up those branches and put those over each rutabaga root. And obviously, I'm talking to gardeners now. Farmers, you'd be rolling your eyes right now if you were thinking about trying to save a field full of rutabagas with any of these methods. Row cover might be possible, but probably not. But for home gardeners, you might try conifer branches too. I've read that that works. I've never done it, but it might be easier to deal with, especially if you don't have leaves that won't blow away. But the other thing that we made it a point to do was we have not a lot, but some remaining carrots in the ground. And those we made sure to put some mulch over because they've been taking all the cold so far. The tops are looking worse and worse, but they're still there. The thing is, at this point, it's going to be cold enough that the top of the carrot, the little part that sticks out of the ground, is very likely to freeze enough to take damage. And that'll allow rot to set in and take out the whole root. So we're pretty much accepting by covering the greens that we're done trying to get size on those roots right now. All we want to do is keep them in a harvestable stage until we harvest them. Those are the kind of things we're dealing with right now. Otherwise, it's looking at seed catalogs and starting some of the beginning successions of things. We may start some more onions this week. We may be starting some greens that we'll put outside in the first thaw of late winter, early spring. We'll be starting successions of lettuce and spinach and stuff that we'll be putting in the greenhouse. We'll be putting a flat of tot soy into our Grandview greenhouse tomorrow. But really, it's a pretty slow time of year for the garden and for all of us. I mean, if we're working our jobs, this kind of weather, I don't know about you, but I like to take a time of year.
We missed the last part of that sentence, Pat.
I said, I don't know about you, but this time of year, I don't mind that I don't have as much gardening to do. It's a good time of year to go a little slower and take it a little bit easier.
It is. And, you know, you get to really enjoy the rich flavor of what is still growing. I was so much enjoying the turnip the other day. I call that planet turnip when they get so big and beautiful like that. And then the baby rutabagas here, just trying to stay ahead of my little vole who's been eating them and enjoying those rich, deep flavors of the winter vegetables. They are such a joy.
They are. They're pretty revelatory. If you haven't had locally grown winter vegetables, you will definitely take note when you purchase them or grow them and eat them. They're just like so much more deeply flavored, so oftentimes sweet, fresh, just really unto themselves. It's a pretty special thing to have fresh food in the wintertime. And Lisa, as you mentioned the vole, let's give a quick review of Jimmy Elizondo's Grazier's Workshop this weekend. It was a spectacular workshop. We had a good turnout for such a lousy day. And everybody that came was pretty rapt. They were serious grazers and had lots of great questions and were really like following his every word. And of course, there was that one moment, which I heard the day before, but I know he mentioned it also in the workshop, where he talked about and he said moles. His first language is Spanish, and it's pretty easy if you're you know, second to English. It's pretty easy for people whose first language is English to think about moles and voles and mix them up. And so I gave Jimmy a little tip for remembering, and actually everybody could probably use this tip. If you're thinking moles, think meat. If you're thinking voles, think vegetables. Moles are vegetarians. They eat the plant roots. They eat the plants. Voles are meat eaters. They're eating the grubs, the worms, stuff like that in the soil. Moles, we don't ever really need to think of as a problem. They're never really going to do much damage to us. They may make a lot of tunnels, but plants know how to work with those tunnels, no problem at all. Voles can be a problem, and most of us speak with moles about voles with a lot of contempt or hostility. I am one of those. You know, anybody who's grown a field full of wonderful sweet potatoes and then gone to harvest them and found up to 75% of the harvest eaten by voles, pretty easy to get mad at that particular critter. But what Jimmy talked about was he learned the power of mycorrhizae from looking at his fields where there were mycorrhizal inoculated crops, and then seeing this line of green go off into another field that didn't have those mycorrhizal inoculated crops. And then he investigated that line. It was a vole tunnel. And it was green because the voles were feeding in the crops that were mycorrhizal inoculated. They were ingesting the spores of the mycorrhizae. And then I'm sure that over evolution, it's evolved that the spores of the mycorrhizae are spectacularly well adapted to going through a mouse's gut or a vole's gut, which what a vole is a mouse, going through their gut and coming out the other end in their poop, ready to land on a root and start growing again. And so why he had that green was because the vole was mycorrhizally inoculating his field. So as we despise voles or rail against the horrible damage and plot their death, we should know that, of course, like every other organism on the planet, they have their place and they are also accomplishing things that we want done.
Right. And, you know, sometimes we don't even have hardly any idea what those little animals are doing. We just barely can scratch the surface, and then we find out there's so much more happening. And that's what we were talking about earlier on the show today. Just like the few weeks ago when we talked about the roly-poly bug, which is not a bug, right? It's a cetacean, and how they can transform heavy metal in the soil through crystallizing it, the ions there, and making it a little pellet. It's like we barely know the very surface of what some of these animals are doing in their intricate place in nature. And it's like once we respect that, we can find out, oh, wow, there's all these other things going on. And protecting biodiversity is really important.
Absolutely. And it is true. The absolute intricacy and perfection of how every creature fits into creation and assures that we have the maximization of life, as much life as can happen given the resource, the major energy source we have, which is the sun. The way that works is something to be constantly amazed by, grateful for, inspired by. It's definitely a deep part of my spirituality to pay attention to those connections, the perfection of them, and how a major goal for all of us should be, I hope, to try to figure out how to become a seamless part of that.
Yeah, it's amazing how you see all this blindness out there. There's fruit farmers out growing mangoes in Mauritius, and they just finished doing a big bat cull and killed well over 20,000 of the flying fox there, beautiful animals. And you know, not even realizing or honoring their place in nature, but just saying, oh, we want more profit on our mangoes, you know, and
yeah,
really amazing.
And indeed, as you talk about that, I'm reminded of the Carolina canary, which, of course, was a parrot, not a canary. And it had two major things going against it, which is why it is no longer existent. And the number one thing was it likes to feed on fruit. So it was a pest of farmers' orchards. But the other problem it had was it had incredible fealty to its flock. And so if you shot one of these, you know, remarkably, I mean, we had a parrot in North Carolina. How wonderful is that? I mean, we think of parrots as tropical, right? But if they shot one of these parrots, the other parrots would keep coming in to the wounded and then get shot too. They couldn't leave one of their own behind. And so the tragedy that we would, you know, as a species would decide that it's fine to just devastate an entire species because they eat our fruit. I mean, you know, Am I not tempted to do that sometimes? I for sure am. I mean, you know, when animals are eating my fruit, I'm always tempted to do something to kill the animal, but really, rarely is that the best solution anyways, because another one will come along. What we need to do always is figure out how to have permanent repelling situations and permanent excluding situations. Unless you want to spend all your time out there shooting every rabbit, trapping every vole, then what we have to do is figure out how to make it so they don't want to be where we grow our food. Or maybe once in a while it's by growing something else that they're more attracted to. But those are f by far the better ways to do this. And I'm very sad to hear that the mango farmers are killing all of those bats, of course. There has to be another solution, and I'm sure there is. But if murder of another species, I guess that's, we only think we're murdering when we kill humans, but if killing another species is your go-to solution, you know, that's your nail, then you're always going to use a hammer. And that's pretty tragic.
Yeah, it's amazing what we can do by honoring life and having fun doing it and have better food in the process. And it's been great, Pat, to see the numbers coming in from last year and the year before. Huge increases in horticultural sales of various kinds of organic foods driving the market. We've got many more community gardens and school gardens starting up and starting to tear away some of that red tape that prevents that food from being served in those schools. And, you know, lots of progress overall. And then meanwhile, we've got just more genetically modified things being rushed to market and all the rest. But it's really great to see we have made quite a bit of progress in moving the markets towards sustainability.
Yeah, I'm confident that we are an inevitability. Simply because I know that we can't survive as a species if we don't go this route, you know. I'm only hoping that that inevitability is rapid enough to have the impact it needs to have with regards to climate change. I have no doubt that the deep logic of organic and sustainable systems, you know, mob grazing systems, pasture farming systems, they are going to sell themselves. People are more and more going to learn the need for them, and more are going to move to those. Consumers are more and more going to decide that they need their food to be nutrient dense and pesticide free, and of course, GMO free. I'm sure that'll happen. I just hope it happens fast enough. And as I think I probably have intimated before, I'm more optimistic on our front, the front that we work on the most, you know. And I am on most other fronts as far as how the human species is doing with regards to the rest of the planet. Pretty excited about the potential. Lisa, I wanted to mention, we've talked about it before here, but I had a phone call from Ben McCann from Goldfinch Gardens. Actually, it was an email. And he was describing holes all throughout his greenhouse in vegetables, in his turnips, in his lettuce, in his crops, in his greenhouse. And he was wondering if the pest, we couldn't figure out what the pest was. He has found it, but he couldn't identify it. And it was a larva, a kind of pretty translucent larva with a noticeably black head. Let's see, about a centimeter long, you know, which is probably what, about 3/4 of an inch or something. Not very big. And he just couldn't figure out what it was, and so he was suspecting his compost because he bought compost and brought it in for the first time. And so I called him rather than typing an answer because I'm not much of a typist, and told him that what he was looking at was the larva of the vegetable weevil. And this is a member of the Coleoptera family, same family as beetles. It's a weevil, and that you can tell that by that snout. It's about, you know, oh, at the most 1/4 inch in size, and probably actually the larva too is probably closer to, I don't know, 1/4 inch or something like that, or a little bit more like a 1/2 inch. But it's a dull gray color, grayish brown color. It's got a snout V-shaped mark on its wing covers, and really, you're more likely to find the larva. The weevils are not in that great a number. There's usually far more larvae. But mostly you'll know you have it because you're going to have holes this time of year. And this usually occurs only in greenhouses. I mean, I have never seen it out in cloches and stuff. I think it's just too cold for them there. But they really can take off and cause a lot of damage in a greenhouse. And so, you know, Ben asked me, well, what is the solution? And We don't have, like, this isn't like, which he tried. He was hoping that it was a larva of a butterfly or a moth. In that case, BT would be the perfect solution. We don't have a BT for the vegetable weevil. So the solutions that I've come up with that have worked well enough for us include, when the plants are young, giving them a drench with neem, and that'll go systemic and make it so that early on, the weevils and the larvae will not be willing to feed on these vegetables. That'll give the vegetables a chance to get bigger and stronger before they do get attacked, and also probably slow down the rate at which this larva and these weevils move back in, because they're going to have thought, oh, that wasn't good, I can't eat that, you know. But they'll eventually try it because they're looking for food, and so that's not a permanent solution. I also recommend it for the younger plants, you know, for any stage up to, let's say, 3 weeks before harvest, spraying with Surround. And this is a, you know, this is not the best advice, because a lot of the crops we grow this time of year are brassicas, and they tend to have a waxy leaf coating, and it's not that easy to get Surround to stick. You'll probably have to spray a couple of times to get it to stick. But if you get it on there when the plants are still young, that's going to make it so once again, these weevils and these larvae just aren't comfortable there. Their furicles are going to be getting clogged up. They're going to have trouble breathing, and they'll have to be desperate for food to take that. It'd be like us trying to eat in a coal mine or something, you know. It's just like so much dust that, yeah, we might do it if we were absolutely starved, but if we had any other option, if we could move to weeds on the edge or anything else, the odds are good that we'd stay away from that. So once again, not a solution in that we don't get rid of the pest, but a way to deter it, reduce its ability to thrive, and reduce the damage to our plants. And then the final thing we do, this is like later when we don't really want to be putting Surround out. We want to have all that white stuff on our crops and stuff. But in that last month or so, we come in and we spray a combination of neem and spinosad. And neither of these alone will kill this insect, but together they put a big enough hurt on them that the damage is acceptable. And that's all we're ever looking for. We're never looking for perfection. We remember, and I'm going to make sure I get that link onto our resource page. We remember the article that talked about the fact that when plants are eaten by insects, they raise the level of antioxidants in the plant to respond to the being eaten. So, of course, they're better for us. So some small level of predation on our vegetables, a few holes, is actually a sign of, once again, healthier food. But none of us want to have it look like it's been hit with a shotgun, which is what can look it look like if we don't do anything to control the vegetable weevil. The other things to know about the vegetable weevil are that its active time is winter through late spring. And really, we don't see much serious problem with it after early spring even. But that means that that's when it's hatching out, that's when it's feeding. So that's when you really want to try and control it so it won't multiply. It spends estivation, its dormancy, in the soil, and that is going to basically, or actually, I'm sorry, not in the soil, in the edges, around the edges of your gardens, right? In the residues, plant residues, weed residues, stuff like that. And then it also, there are eggs that they lay in the soil, and they can mature in as little as 4 days or take as much as a month, depending on soil temperature. But that, because there is that soil factor, if we could have it so that when they were actually in the soil and hatching out, they have to move out of the soil. If we had high levels of nematodes in the soil, then we could totally control them. The problem is they tend to be in the soil and hatching out in cold weather, and our nematodes are pretty much, beneficial nematodes need 60 degrees in order to be active. There are, apparently, according to Dr. Richard McDonald, nematodes out there not yet commercially available that are active at 45 degrees. That would solve the problem. I'm going to keep raising my voice to all of the pertinent suppliers, saying that we would love for them to bring those to market. The problem is, will there be enough demand? I don't know. I sure want them, but how many other vegetable growers have this problem, and will they use them? I don't know. But whether or not we have the nematode solution, one thing they recommend is cultivating the soil in the wintertime, because you'll be disturbing those eggs and disturbing those newly hatched larvae. of course, we're totally in a no-till, and that's part of why we have this problem. So the jury's still out as to whether or not we'll go with cultivation. I think we might need to if we don't get a grip otherwise, but before I got on the air with you, I actually went to a web page and looked up the vegetable weevil and got the piece that I didn't have before, which is that they do that estivation, that dormancy time, in your edges and where the residue is. So I'm thinking now that if we come through about when we expect them to be in there, which would be in the early fall, if we do a really major cleanup of our edges, mow them really well, and maybe come through and even like spray, I'm not sure what it would be, maybe neem or something after we mow, to really put a major hurt on those dormant weevils, we might be able to get control despite the fact that we can't get nematodes to work. So those are the solutions. If you punch in vegetable weevil in your computer, you'll get to see pictures of them. But if you're wondering what is making your vegetables look like somebody took a shotgun to them, this time of year, it is most likely the vegetable weevil. I think I'll write a little piece of this on this subject for our next newsletter, because I'm realizing that invariably, if people have this problem and they haven't figured it out yet, they're going to need an alternative source for information. I brought this weevil to Extension years ago, and they did get me the answer, but it took them about 2 weeks. It's not something our Extension agents have a lot of experience with, because there isn't that much winter growing. There'll be more and more experience, but at the moment, if we can get the word out to people, we might save a lot of pretty traumatic experience, because you can definitely see some major damage from the vegetable weevil.
Yeah, it's just one of those mysterious things. A lot of people just have no idea what it is. And it's great to be able to look at really being able to mitigate that, see about doing it in a way that still honors nature, still honors all the biodiversity, and keeps those shotgun shell looks from the leaves. But I love it that they're actually more nutritious when they get that insect pressure. And, you know, especially kids, oh, look, there's something wrong with that. I was like, look, honey, the ones that look perfect aren't even good for you. And this one is even better for you. You have no idea, you know. So it's really great to be able to tell that story about the levels of antioxidants and how the plant had to withstand that and then becomes better for us. So it'd be great to get that article up when you have that.
Yeah, I'll make sure and send that link to you. And indeed, I think we could say to the kids, you know, if the bugs didn't want to eat it, why would we want to eat it? It probably isn't very good, right? I mean, it's a sign that it's good food, that everybody wants to eat it, you know? That might be a way to get the kids to think about it, too.
Right. That's what the old Russian farmers say. If there's fruit on the table and there's no fruit flies around it, then don't eat it. That's a good thing. And actually, Carl Warkomsky was complaining the other day about he had a little fruit fly infestation. Where'd they all come from? And I remember the 1 year I actually cultivated fruit flies over Christmas, because I had that praying mantis egg case hatched on my Christmas tree. Hundreds of those babies. Now I'm over here praying for fruit flies. That was the only time that ever happened. But
How many of those babies did you manage to keep alive?
Well, I kept... It started out, there was hundreds of them everywhere. And, you know, being a mom, it's like, I can't feed all the babies. You know, it was causing me all this anxiety. And I was calling every pet store and trying to come up with fruit flies. And of course, they want live prey. So if you kill something, they don't eat it. It has to be like, you have to half kill a fruit fly, which is very hard. And then I was over there struggling, and I had them going and going, and they were just dying by the dozens. And I was still keeping them going. And I went and got paint filters, you know, the paint filter thing to cut, like you can cover with the paint can filter thing, and you covered that, so it's like a little screen. So I made these little habitats for them. Well, they're territorial, and they want distance to claim their territory. So they were all cooped up in there, and I had quite a few growing quite well until the one dominant one just ate everybody.
Yep, that's what happens. That's what I would have expected you to say. I mean, that is basically the story of praying mantises. They're when that female is laying those eggs, the intention is not that there's going to be hundreds and hundreds of praying mantises. Really, the environment couldn't handle that, you know. Basically, she's putting them out there, and the genetic selection is going to pick the one or maybe three or something like that. They're going to thrive and be able to fill that particular little niche, you know. If every egg casing of praying mantises hatched everyone out, and of course, nowhere near all the egg cases even make it to a point where they hatch. Lots of them get hit by ants and other things, and none hatch out at all. And yet we still have plenty of praying mantises, you know. And I want to mention to folks, you know, years ago, one of our organic supermarkets was actually selling praying mantis egg casings. Somebody collected a bunch and brought them in, and they were selling them. And that was really misguided. For one thing, yes, there's a lot of reproduction out there, but if you're removing them, you're removing them from places where nature says this is where one needs to be. If you go moving those around and all that, you're probably throwing off the balance in places you're taking them out of. And then the other piece is, years ago, Jim Klutz, he's now passed away, but he used to own the Beneficial Insect Company, and he was one of the first beneficial insect talks I ever went to. And somebody asked about, you know, what insects he had for sale, and they said, well, can we buy praying mantises from you? He said, no, I won't sell them. And they said, why not? He said, because basically, and you've probably heard me say this before, praying mantises are essentially the T-Rex of the insect world. And that's a very good description of them because they kind of look like T-Rex, you know. And they eat everything. And they're voracious. I mean, as you learn, they have big appetites and they eat everything. And if you have more than the natural balance, if you go ahead and artificially increase that balance by bringing in egg casings, what's going to happen is you're going to have way more predation than you want, and a lot of beneficial insects are going to get eaten. And then, of course, eventually, because there are too many praying mantises, several of them are going to have to move on, and then you're going to have this gap. You're going to have no other predators. And what does that mean? That means that the herbivores are going to go crazy. You're going to have this outbreak of pests eating your food before the predators come back in. So, you know, bringing in, moving around, praying mantis egg casings is actually probably looking at disturbing the natural balance.
Right. Yeah, I was over there at a Christmas tree farm when my son was little, and we're going to get the Christmas tree now. And, oh, it's just a part of nature. Let's leave it on there. Well, little did I know what I was about to do. So, yeah, it was a bajillion little babies for Christmas that all dried up and fell over within a few days, and I was just horrified.
Right. Yeah. I mean, now, you know, really the ideal would have been to say, hey, can we snip this branch off without hurting the tree? And can you take those back to your, to your farm and put those out there?
Yeah, should just put it out in nature and not let it be a thing, because I did not know it was filled with little babies that were going to pop out the minute that they got in that warm room.
Yep.
Yeah. So I ended up with super praying mantis, one giant super survivor. And I was so mad at that little praying mantis for eating everybody. I had worked so hard that I was like, okay, winter's about over. You're a survivor. Okay, go. And I went ahead and let him out in a kind of a sheltered area. I thought, okay, I've had it. I've had it with this guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he didn't have enough room anyway, or she or whatever.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah, they were just doing what they're supposed to do, of course. But, yeah, I could understand the being horrified at watching all of those siblings being devoured.
In one night. Yeah. One night, the rest of the whole, everybody was gone.
Yep.
And I'm looking around, where are they at? Where are they? I'm looking up and down, all up in. I had all plants in there. I had this whole little ecosystem going. Oh, yeah, Mr. Supermantis had done it. And it was really something. It's like, well, don't mess with nature. Nature's got it. But, yeah, you're right. And it was devastating. Hey, Pat, you know, I just remembered something that we get questions about from time to time. And I just thought I should mention that, since I just heard about it and it's fresh on my mind. The Henderson County Beekeepers Association has registration open for bee school.
Yeah, totally. If you want to keep bees, you should definitely attend that. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's starting up, and they've got it right now. The event is open for registration, and they've got all kinds of things you can learn. A lot of people want to raise bees, and they don't know where to start. This is a great one. So it is starting up right away, so people can find out.
You want to move on that pretty quick. As I think, was it you? Somebody else I know actually was trying to get a hive started and realized that they hadn't ordered their starter colony early enough, and they were questioning whether they'd even get one this year. There's only a certain number of starter colonies that are going to be available. And so you want to move on in a timely way. And I don't have a lot of expertise in that. I had a short foray as a beekeeper back in the the early 90s, and realized that I had too much else going on. I wasn't going to be able to focus enough. But I do know that it's not like a guarantee you're going to be able to get that colony if you don't go ahead and get started early, learn what you need to do, get yourself set up so you can order that starter colony and get it in there in a timely way and be sure that you get one before the supply runs dry.
Yeah, it's available. You can check it out, Henderson County, hcbeekeepers.org, hcbeekeepers.org. And, you know, Pat, during that super warm end of the year there with Christmas time, I had, of course, again, my mustard flowering, that wild mustard. I keep letting it flower all over. And I had bees on top of bees on top of bees during that warm weather trying to get those flowers. No flowers were anywhere except here in the yard. And I've never seen so many bees at one time. It was phenomenal. And it really made me think about, you know, everything you teach about having pollinator habitats, because those bees knew those flowers were there and they could not wait for that little meal, that little snack before this next big cold snap came. So it was really great to have them out there.
It's really, yeah, if you can, you know, give yourself the pleasure of having winter blooms, you are doing wonderful things for all of the diversity. Because I guarantee you, Lisa, the bees might have been most noticeable, but there were also tiny little wasps in there and other forms of life, all of whom are trying to make it through the winter. And when they take the chance and venture out from their dormancy because the weather is warm, if they don't get a meal, their odds go way down because they've used their reserves looking for food. If they score, they probably have raised their odds. But if they don't get a meal, if they do that foraging and don't get a meal, that probably greatly reduces their chance of survival.
I felt good about it. You're right. There were wasps in there, little native bees, the little golden bees, green ones, honey bees, bumblebees. Oh, every kind of bee I've ever seen was there, just piled up. And, you know, I've even let Broccoli Rob and some other stuff just go to flower just so there could be some more flowers out there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They know it and they love it. And I'm so happy to be able to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very positive thing to do, to realize that, you know, the vegetable crops we grow are also a key piece of our farmscaping. And oftentimes in the winter, they're, you know, the other flowers that you might possibly get this time of year, basically calendulas, dandelions. I don't know that they go to witch hazel, but it's possible witch hazel would still be flowering right now. Pussy willows will be coming on pretty soon. If they don't take damage from this cold, because they have gotten bigger than they normally do this time of year because of that warm spell. But they're usually our first major feed is all of the willow flowers. That's the first tree basically to come in flower. I'm watching the big wind here, Lisa.
You know, I'm getting a big wind too, Pat. We've got a big wind blowing through here right now as well.
Just blew the lattices that were on my deck for shade. Blew both of them off.
Wow. I think these are the snow shower winds that are coming in.
Yep. Yeah. I've been thinking about taking those off anyways. I guess I don't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah. Nature just did it for you, right? Yep. How nice. Thank you.
Anyway, that's why I said earlier it would be the I Love Lucy show to try and put cover out tonight. You might want to go with one of those other methods. But definitely with this kind of wind, this kind of cold, if you can protect your plants, they'll appreciate it for sure.
All right. Well, great. Any closing words you have for us today besides protecting our plants, which is definitely going to be, I might just be picking some more rutabagas right now.
You know, as I look at that wind, you know, it's like, it reminds me of what we said earlier about the vole. I mean, you know, to us, it's always an inconvenience if there's something that happens that means that our plans were altered and stuff, you know, but for sure, every wind that doesn't take trees down strengthens them, you know. The wind is, of course, like allowing various forms of life to be moved around, to raise that diversity. Of course, you know, that's how we got the hemlock woolly adelgid spread everywhere, was by those winds. That's how they moved around. But just once again, you know, enjoy the power of it. You know, hopefully you won't take any major damage from it. But to me, you know, since I can sit inside, I don't have to work outside today. I have work to do, but it'll be inside. That wind is just something to admire, and I hope for everybody, rather than something that makes them a little uneasy or whatever, they get to appreciate the wonder of our planet. You know, someday I'm going to read it. I got one of my books sitting on the bookshelf as a natural history of the wind, and I look forward. Someday I'll be telling you more fascinating details about the wind. But I guess that's a good one too. Appreciate it all and keep learning. The more we learn, the more we can appreciate, the less likely we'll be liable to consider ourselves the overarching arbiter of how all things should happen. I really hope that something that people get from this radio show is that we will thrive and our planet will thrive the more we learn to be a part of it all rather than try to be in charge of it all.
That sounds great. Perfectly good sense to take nature's lead, and then maybe we'll actually get down the road together.
Amen.
In a better way.
Well, stay warm.
All right, you too, and don't blow away in the wind. Hopefully the roads will stay nice and safe out there, and we'll talk to you next week, Pat.
Okay, all right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That is Patrick Battle, This Week in the Garden, and we get to talk about lots of good details, too, about those vegetable larvae and learning the little weevils there and all the little stuff and how we can work it out naturally. We don't need to hammer everything with chemicals and poison, right? Because we are part of that. So great to hear from Pat today and, of course, every week here on Earth Heart Network Radio. We'll talk to you soon and look forward to sharing more information about the Land to Mouth Food, Farm, and Garden Connection. Talk to you soon.